Good afternoon. Let's open the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means on Wednesday, February 15th, 2012. I would like anyone who's here to testify about House Bill 4168 or 4169 to be aware of dash two amendments. There's a dash two amendment on 4168 and there's a dash two amendment on 4169. And I want to make sure you're aware of that as you prepare to testify. So let's open a public hearing on House Bill 4168. Mr. Borden.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. House Bill 4168 makes changes to the current law implementation of House Bill 2710. The measure clarifies the financial implementation of House Bill 2710, which is the civil filing fee bill, by specifying what fees are applicable when, payable by whom, and for what amount. It reestablishes the exemption for the court charging public bodies a copying fee, and also codifies fees established by Chief Justice order, among other technical changes. Again, there is a dash two amendment to this bill. The dash two amendment directs that the state court administrator is to study the historic funding levels of county law libraries and conciliation mediation services and report back to the Legislative Assembly by December 31st, 2012. The Legislative Fiscal Office has been visiting with the Judicial Department to see if they have a fiscal impact. And we note that during the 2010 interim, there was an extensive study by the Joint Interim Committee on State Justice System Revenues, and the Judicial Department has a lot of this data on hand if the scope of the amendment is quite limited. So they're prepared to pull that data. They think they have a minimal fiscal impact. If the study is more extensive, then the department will need to come back for additional funds. And with that, Madam Chair and members of the committee, Dave Hendricks is here to walk through the introduced measure as well as the amendment if need be.
I think I'd like to hear testimony first, and then when the committee is ready to discuss the bill, we'll ask Mr. Hendricks to come help us understand it in the context of the testimony that we hear. I have three people who have indicated an interest in testifying on House Bill 4168. So Mr. Kyler, Alex Kyler, Paul Snyder, and Daryl Fuller. Do we have three chairs available?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Come on up and tell us what we need to know. Mr. Kyler.
Thank you. Committee, for the record, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Manager for Lane County. But, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lane County tracked closely the work that you mentioned of the Interim Justice System Revenue Committee. We also followed closely the development of House Bill 2710 and House Bill 2712. We were particularly interested and concerned about the family mediation programs and the funding for those programs as the add-on fee that had been in place prior to House Bill 2710 was transferred to an appropriation. There were some numbers generated during the evolution of the bill, and as we checked those numbers against our local programs, especially in Lane County, but with some other county lobbyists that I was working with, we had some questions. And as you recall, those bills were rather quickly processed towards the end of the session. We had had a proposal to carve out the family mediation programs. There was a nice, at least personally, there was a nice methodology for raising or for adjusting add-on fees that involved the approval first of the presiding court judge in the county before it could go to the Board of Commissioners. The Board of Commissioners was unable to raise those fees without approval of the presiding court judge. At any rate,
the bill passed. We have now experienced some time with that, and I sought the amendment in that as I looked at a number of the counties, and you'll see of seven counties that I've looked at here, all of them resulted in less amount of funding over the biennium as a result of the appropriation than they would have enjoyed without the bill. The issue struck me because time and time again throughout the process, we were assured that it was really designed to be a revenue-neutral process, and that's why I asked for the amendment. I would point out the salient point for Lane County and for the tri-counties of Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas is that we had processed through the procedure I mentioned a rate increase. In Lane County, we had done the rate increase in May 2010. So I was concerned that as this historical analysis was developed in order to make the system revenue neutral, that the May 2010 fee increase just wouldn't sway the average enough to really put us into play where we thought we were as of about June 2011. And in the tri-counties, the situation was a little worse because in April, May of 2010, they did a rate increase of 12%. All three of the counties did a rate increase of 12% with then a schedule for 6% increases over the next 3 years. So while my chart shows a relative flatness, some revenue loss, but a relative flatness of funding, they actually had pre-programmed some new revenue that then was eliminated from this picture. So Lane County's shortfall due to the rate increase, we actually thought we were going to enjoy quite a bit more, $1 million plus in revenue. So our shortfall was $267,000. If you look at the tri-counties, they were also in the couple $100,000 losses. And that's what we hope the study brings to light and informs you for future appropriations. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Kyler. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For Mr. Gordon, actually, does this look right, and how did we get to this point?
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Hicks, we'll need to look at this in detail, but just for the committee's as a reminder to the committee, there were some temporary surcharges during the 2009-11 biennium that resulted in a significant increase in temporary one-time revenue for law libraries of over $2 million. And so the study will be a good thing to kind of examine what historic funding levels were and to confirm what the Interim Committee on State Justice System Revenues was looking at, and look at make sure that the one-time revenue sources are not included in it, and also make sure that the local any local fees are not included either. So,
okay. Thank you.
Anybody else? Thanks, Mr. Snyder.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. We support the Dash 2 amendments for the reason Mr. Kyler has already identified. We also support the printed bill with respect specifically to the exemptions for public bodies in terms of the fees that were provided prior to passage of House Bill 2710.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Thanks. Mr. Fuller?
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the subcommittee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Our concerns are the same that were mentioned by Mr. Snyder, so I won't take up any more time of the committee other than the sheriffs are concerned about the revenue neutrality of the original bill, and we appreciate the committee looking at some adjustments for us. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Mr. Hendricks, just in case.
Co-Chair Nolan, Co-Chair Centers, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks from Legislative Council's office. You should have my memo. I think it was distributed at the last meeting that kind of did the section by section on it. As you can see, most of the bill is fix-it things for the major restructuring of filing fees we did last session in House Bill 2710. Not a very big document. That's a good thing. Probably the most significant piece has already been referred to, and that was the copying fees for public bodies, which was buried pretty deep, but quickly came to the attention of the district attorneys and other state agencies who were going to be required to pay copying fees and who had not in the past. It may be an issue that comes back before you again. It's been up before because, you know, the courts have had an issue in the past with respect to unlimited copying services for the state agencies, and at some point it may bear some additional looking at for perhaps one free copy or something along those lines. But at this point, all we're doing is reinstating the status quo as it was before 2710 passed. I'd be happy to try to answer any other questions you've got on the bill.
I think Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Hendricks, as to the dash two amendments, my reading of it is that it simply directs a study and does not direct that the legislature take particular action based upon the study. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Nolan, Co-Chair Winters, that's correct. Representative Hicks, it's just to take a look at what happened was is there used to be a bunch of add-on fees that went on to the filing fees. There was one that was for these family mediation programs. There was an add-on to the court fees that was for, you know, law libraries. And the bill at that 2710 basically eliminated those and did direct appropriations out with distributions down to the counties for at least these two, to basically attempt to keep them whole, hold them where they were at when they were getting the fees directly from the court. And so the issue with the study is how accurately is that distributing the money? How close was it to the projections that they thought? And are they different counties doing better than other counties underneath the pre-existing law?
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else? Thank you, Mr. Hendricks. Anyone else wishing to testify on 4168? Close a public hearing on 4168. Let's open a work session on 4168. We've heard the description of the Dash 2 amendment. Madam Co-Chair?
Madam Co-Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 4168.
Senator Winters moves the adoption of the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 4168. Discussion? Objections? Amendment is adopted. Madam Co-Chair.
Madam Co-Chair, I move House Bill 4168 to the full Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Senator Winters moves House Bill 4168 to the full Joint Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion? Any objections? Motion carries. Carriers. Mr. Hendricks, can you carry this on the floor? Because you're the only one who can explain it.
You can sit with him. No, Joanne knows that.
I can take it.
Verger will take it to the full committee and the
point.
Senate floor. And I think Representative Smith will carry it on the House floor.
That's what he gets for not being here.
Close the work session on 4168. Open a public hearing on House Bill 4169. Mr. Borden.
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, before you is House Bill 4169. It resolves technical issues with conflicts amendments with the following four bills from the 2011 session: House Bill 3075, House Bill 2104, House Bill 2710, and House Bill 2712. These four bills modified fees that defendants pay when convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants and to petition for diversion. The four bills conflicted in regards to the amount of the fee amounts and the distribution of funds. House Bill 4169 clarifies the fee amounts and the distribution of revenue. There is a preliminary fiscal impact that you have received, and also there is a Dash 2 amendment to this bill. The Dash 2 amendment does three things. It lowers the district attorney diversion fee to $100 and it provides for waiver and deferral of the fee by a judge, and it renames the filing fee to a program fee.
Thank you. Mr. Borden. We have Deborah Bond, Paul Snyder, and Daryl Fuller, if you can come forward to testify. Oh, are we limited to two seats? If you only have two, that's fine. We'll call them up in twos. Ms. Bond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deborah Bond, I'm the Finance Director for the City of Salem. Before you have some written testimony, I would like to mostly speak specifically to the section that deals with the Dewey diversion, because there are amendments into Section 1. This bill increases the Dewey diversion filing fee from $386 to $490, and currently the city under House Bill 2712 retains $223 of that fee. With the House Bill 4169, we would retain only $200 of a higher fee under this bill. The city believes the diversion programs, both of them, are very successful and beneficial to the communities in the state by intervention into substance abuses and addictions. And these programs also reduce the likelihood of future abuses and the resulting negative impacts on families and our communities. Many of the people who enter these programs struggle to pay the current fee for these programs. And we believe that the increasing the fee, particularly in the diversion area of the Deweys, will place an option of the diversion out of reach for many folks who would otherwise participate in and benefit from them. We also believe that the increased fees will result in a higher cost to our municipal court, our court operations, because these cases will more than likely go to trial due to the inability to complete diversion, DUI diversions, with paying their fees. The city's court costs for court time, police officers' time, and prosecutors' time, indigent, defense and related costs will increase. And if the bill passed, the city's offsetting revenues from paying the costs of these cases would further decline. Our municipal court is in our city's general fund, and the city is in its fourth year of general fund reductions or cuts. The reduced revenue and increasing costs of operating are requiring the city to make permanent cuts into its general fund of approximately $10.5 million starting this year and over the subsequent next three years. We are now at a point of reducing the number of our officers, reducing our staffing hours and one of our fire stations, and further reducing other amenities such as parks, libraries, planning, and other needs of community, so further eroding the loss of these revenues that help support and offset some of our cost administration for courts will result in further cost reductions for our community. Thank you for your time.
Questions for Ms. Bond? Representative Hicks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this may be one to keep in the bag for Mr. Hendricks, but my reading of the Dash 2 amendments is that it doesn't apply to Dewey diversion. It's only
right.
Okay.
Right.
I understand that amendment. This deals with Section 4, which is specifically on the Dewey diversion program.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Snyder.
Madam Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. We've heard tell of the Dash 2 amendments, and what we heard sounds good. It addresses the issues that were of concern to the sheriffs and the district attorneys and to our members in our public safety committee. We share the concerns raised by the City of Salem with regard to the DUII diversion, and other than that, I have nothing more to add.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions?
I do have a question.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, because whether or not, particularly Mr. Snyder, this issue on the Deweys, was that discussed prior to? This is not the first time we've heard the content of this particular piece of legislation. So did the Association of Oregon Cities and Counties weigh in and have discussion on the issue that's being raised by the City of Salem at that time?
Madam Co-Chair, no, we did not at the time. We didn't before.
Okay. Did the City of Salem?
As a new member in the City of Salem, I can't really answer how much was involved or weighing in on, say, when 2712, I believe, Senator, that's your question, was in play.
I don't recall. Thank you.
Thank you.
Daryl Fuller and Gail Meyer.
Madam Co-Chair, if I may add just one comment.
Ms. Snyder.
In response to Senator Winter's question, I wasn't aware of that issue until earlier this afternoon. So it was my fault in not noticing that issue when I first read the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I would like to thank Co-Chair Nolan and others, staff and others who worked with us in creating the Dash 2 amendment. We were operating in a void of data, really, as to how important this one DA diversion statute was in terms of implementing treatment courts around the state. We didn't know the degree to which it was utilized in different counties or in municipal courts or in justice courts, but we did really share mutual concerns that if the $335 fee were to remain, that it could be an inhibitor, a disincentive for people to enter the program. Additionally, as originally drafted, the bill didn't have any provision at all for waiver with indigency. We do appreciate very much the amended language in the Dash 2. It caps the program fee at $100 with the understanding, really, the logic that was designed to replace the loss of the unitary assessment that had gone away. This $100 program fee could be waived in whole or in part by the court based on indigency and allowed for installment basis. We think that's calibrated enough that would satisfy our concerns that there not be any inhibition or disincentive for people to utilize this diversion. Madam Co-Chair Nolan, we had not had discussions about the DUI diversion. If I might just add anecdotally for the committee, my members at the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association that represent people who do have DUI charges, there's a little mini expertise within our membership. They are reporting to me that the more fees that get imposed on the DUI option is making the DUI option less and less attractive to their clients. And generally, in their view, public safety is promoted when that option becomes the no-brainer. Of course you're going to go to diversion because that's the only option you're going to want to undertake. What we did in 2011 is make installation of ignition interlock devices mandatory throughout the diversion. And that is expensive. The first year alone with installation and monthly expenses, that's a good $1,000 in the first year. So you add that in addition to the treatment fees, the assessment fees, the conviction fee, and the program fee, it gets very expensive. And the conversations my members are having with their clients are to the effect that they have to talk longer about whether or not this is an attractive option. And I was just simply to share that with the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Fuller.
Co-chairs, member of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. With the exception of looking over my colleagues' shoulders, I've not seen the Dash 2 amendments, but from what I've heard, they address the concerns that we'd mentioned previously. We appreciate their being drafted. And our concern, again, was a program fee that would be too high for people to take advantage of them. So we appreciate the adjustments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Thanks. Thank you. Scott Winkles and Elizabeth Kushwa.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We're here in support of the Dash 2 amendments to 4169. First of all, before I start anything, I'd like to say thank you to Mr. Borden for all of the work he has done on this, and Mr. Hendricks. They have done an enormous amount of work, and I am personally, professionally very grateful. Our issue with the bill as drafted is that most defendants who are eligible for DA diversions are indigent, and placing this fee, $335 fee, seemed exorbitant to us, especially since most defendants who participate in this are required to complete treatment programs, drug, alcohol, domestic violence, mental health, parenting, classes and groups, and they're responsible for those fees themselves. To add an additional fee to be able to enter as a condition of entering the program without provisions for indigence or installment payments seemed egregious to us. So we're very much appreciative of the fact that the amount has been reduced to recover the unitary assessment that we had lost before, that it splits the baby very nicely between the misdemeanor and the felony assessments that we lost, as well as creating those provisions for indigence and installment payments, allowing people to actually enter and complete these programs. In terms of the Dewey piece, I feel that it made a lot of sense the way the bill was drafted, because we didn't take into account last year with 2712 that loss of unitary assessment. You had imposed a certain amount that you thought you were charging people, and then this is just making up for that, so we're very comfortable with that. We thank the co-chairs for working with us on the Dash 2 and appreciate your time.
Questions for Ms. Kushwa? Mr. Winkles.
Madam Co-Chair, Nolan, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. I have read the Dash 2s on my phone, if I've read them correctly in small type. We do like them. That DA diversion plan, from what I've heard from some municipal courts in the city, that's typically used for young people, teenagers, college kids in their 20s who, through a lack of judgment, have done something that we probably don't want to color for the rest of their lives. This is a good tool to divert them, and a burden of $335 on that population, I think, would have been a hardship and would have resulted in more trials. I will, to address Senator Winter's question, I will confess to have not quite catching that DUI issue early on. For that, I regret that and do apologize. We do support our member city of Salem in seeking to keep this revenue neutral. We do have several municipal courts throughout the state who are hearing and prosecuting DUI cases. We believe that we're providing a public safety service to our communities, and we are also taking the burden away from circuit court and the county district attorneys by doing so. We produce some pretty good justice out of these courts, and we'd like to keep them operating.
Any questions for Mr. Winkles? Thanks. Anyone on the committee wish to have questions answered by Ledge Council? Okay, great. One last call, testimony on House Bill 4169.
Madam Chair, I would like
Madam
to
Co-Chair.
Ask a question of our staff, if there's some way that we can't get, because I'm concerned about the Dewey and the City of Salem, if we can get some report back to let us know what really kind of adverse effect that this may have on them, because we may have to look at a remedy when we come back in 2013.
If I may, Madam Chair, Senator Winters, the 2011 session did contemplate that there may be some implementation issues with House Bill 2710 and 12, and so they established an interim committee on state justice system revenues. So this would be an ideal topic for the stakeholders to bring before that interim committee, which should start meeting sometime this spring.
Just for the record, so that I can the City of Salem would have an opportunity to be involved in that discussion.
Okay, good point. Thank you.
Never mind, I'll cut you.
Well, just if I may.
In public hearing?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just to note, I understand where they're pointing the discrepancy, because they're keeping $20 less per case than they were before. And so I just want to note that we see that. Thank you for the testimony. Glad to hear that's going to be examined in the interim. Good. I mean, yeah.
Good point. Okay. With that, close the public hearing on House Bill 4169 and open a work session on House Bill 4169.
Madam
Co-Chair.
Co-Chair, I move that we adopt the -2 amendments to House Bills 4169.
Senator Winters moves the adoption of the -2 amendment to House Bill 4169. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none?
Madam Co-Chair, I move House Bill 4169 to the full Joint Committee on Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation as amended.
Thank you. Senator Winters moves House Bill 4169 to the full Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion on the motion? Any objections? Motion carries. I'll carry it in full.
And I'll carry it in full.
And the Senator Winters will carry it on the Senate floor. Close the work session on House Bill 4169. Thank you. Any reason to go anything other than straight order here? Let's open a work session on the Military Department Report on Comprehensive Strategic Plan.
Clear the room.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department, and I'm also the interim head of the Office of Emergency Management. Today, reference our strategic or budget notes that we had in the 2011 session. We're here to report to you, and you should have in front of you. And we'll put it up on the screen as well. And with me today also is Sean McCormick, who is out of our comptroller office. And we're discussing the purposes to discuss our long-range strategic plan, which is requested in that budget note. as we approached the development of the strategic plan, we wanted to document which would act as an understandable tool to be used by the people to begin or enhance the understanding of the Oregon Military Department, what we do. We also wanted the document to provide an overall mission of the agency, which is to defend and protect the state. This mission is clearly defined by Section 1, Article 10 of the Oregon Constitution, and is detailed and within Oregon Revised Statutes, Chapters 396, 398, 399, 401, and 403. To do this, we divided our agency into 10 functional divisions. These include the Oregon National Guard, our command group, Office of Emergency Management, Youth Challenge Program, Starbase Program, our Yellow Ribbon Program, our Reintegration, Counter Drug Program, Oregon State Defense Force, Operations Division, and our Services Division. This division is required due to the unique aspects of all of these different functions. Some divisions perform a defense function, some an emergency response function, some an education function, and some treatment and rehabilitation, as we mentioned with the reintegration. By separating the agency into the component pieces, we were able to identify the unique missions, challenges, and opportunities within each division. The first stage of the process was to develop a mission statement for every division, which we previously had, but we needed to combine them and get them in sync. We then asked our leadership within all of these divisions to identify goals and objectives to support the agency in the divisional missions, which we are focused on achieving over the next 5 years. Now, with the governor's plan to look at a 10-year look at the budget, we're expanding that look to do that with a biennial two-year review of where we're at in meeting those goals. Once we identified them, we asked the leaderships to outline the steps to be taken to accomplish them. This process required our leaders to work closely with the staffs to identify the most critical areas of improvement or for improvement and what needs to be done to make these improvements a reality. As you probably noticed, there's very little reference to costs associated with the goals and objectives identified by the division. We recognize that the costs are an important factor when developing future plans, particularly as we look at the 10-year plan that the governor is working on presently. But for the purposes of this document, we felt it would provide more value to the end user if the costs were left unspecified. Please remember that the goals of this document are not to be a budget, but instead it's means and a roadmap for long-term success for our organization. However, we do intend to use this strategic plan to help craft future budgets.
As you review these strategic plans, please understand it's a living, breathing document which will never really be finalized. The goals and objectives of our organization will continue to change as our mission at home and abroad changes. But rest assured that no matter the conditions, fiscal or otherwise, we'll always be ready and we'll always be there for the citizens of the state of Oregon. That concludes my testimony, and I can walk you through the plan. As you see, that's the leading page, and I think you've got one of these in front of you. There's a comment, the contents, and then we go to the Adjutant General statement, which pretty much says the same thing I just told you. Next, we look at our command group, and you can see the mission on this is to provide command and control over the Oregon Military Department, the Army National Guard, the Air National Guard, Office of Emergency Management, Youth Challenge, and the State Defense Force. I won't read these to you. You can read them, and I'll certainly answer any questions in each section as we go through, depending on how much time you want to spend, unless you'd like me to read them. I didn't think so. again, we have two organizations, obviously, the Army Guard and the Air Guard. So we looked at the Army National Guard in the next slide, and it gives you the strategic goal, which is mobilize ready units for full-spectrum operations. That includes everything from floods, forest fires, or deploy into theaters that the national authority mobilizes our troops to do. And that creates all kinds of different branches and sequels, depending on what those missions are, i.e., we don't reintegrate people after a state emergency. We don't think it's necessary. But we do that after they've been deployed for, in a combat theater. So there are, like I say, they branch and they sequel out. Next page, we finish up with the Army Guard. We go to the Air National Guard, which is one of the most important aspects of what we do on a 24/7 mission. I think all of you are aware of it, but we have jet fighters on 24/7 standby at the Portland Air Base that provides sovereign air control or air sovereignty over the Pacific Northwest. Our area goes above the border north of the state of Washington into Canada. It goes as far south as almost Sacramento in California, and that's the area that we are presently. That is our coverage area. We keep two F-15s on 24/7 standby alert, completely loaded, ready to roll, and they activation by NORAD or North American Air Defense Command. They leave Portland and they go to wherever they're told to go to. The moment that order comes down, we have a standing agreement with the governor. The federal government has a standing agreement that the governor has agreed to, that the minute that horn goes off and those people activate, then they are now no longer in the Oregon National Guard. They are under federal orders, and they respond to that authority, not to the governor. The minute they get back, park their jets, they're back under the governor. It's fairly unique, but it's very much a cost savings method. And, of course, we also have our air base at Klamath Falls, which is the only F-15 training air base in the Air Force inventory. We train both active duty and National Guard F-15 pilots at Klamath Falls. And those are we have other dogs and cats inside of each one of those entities, but that's the two big missions. The next page is the Office of Emergency Management, and again, our goal there is to prepare response and recovery efforts during emergencies, man-made natural disasters that will impact Oregon. We're one of the smallest offices of emergency management in the West, but we have been able to leverage a lot of federal funds into that office. They essentially, in many respects, are very much a bank. And when local communities get impacted, like the recent floods we had, then all those dollars go through the Office of Emergency Management to assist local governments under the rules of the Federal Emergency Management Administration. Next. Slide you have in there is our Youth Challenge program. I know several of you are familiar with that. It's a program we run over in Bend. Our goal there is to recruit immense sufficient numbers of folks to keep our federal monies coming in. But essentially, what we do is we take high school dropouts and we reengage them back into high school as the preference to get their diploma, and or we are certified high school, we can issue a diploma, or they can elect to go for a GED. Those are three options. Or the last option is to earn enough credits to go back to their high school and reenter where they were, and they can earn up to 8.5 credits in a 22-week program. very successful program. It's been around now since 1994, which is, what, 18 years, I guess. And we have been noted by the federal government on many occasions as the best program in the United States. Our Starbase program is primarily run through the Air National Guard. This is we have two Starbase programs, one at Portland Air National Guard Base and one at Klamath Falls, and our air base at Klamath Falls. This is a science and technology, engineering, mathematics concept, hands-on, and the reason we have it at the air base is it relates to how what you have to know in science and math in order to fly an airplane and connect the dots so kids learn in a different fashion. These are primarily, this program is primarily or exclusively directed at, I think the term is Title I, but I'm not an educator, but it's the poor free lunch, free, you know, that group. We provide all of the funds. The school district picks a teacher. We pay for that. We pay for the kids to be brought to the air base, and all of the costs of that are borne by this program through the National Guard Bureau. So the school district basically gets a free math and science program to bring their kids in. It's typically a five-day course, but it's one day a week for 5 weeks where they come to the air base. It's been very successful, and we're very proud of that program.
A question. Yeah. Approximately how many students have you had going through that program?
I don't know that off the top of my head. A typical session runs about 25, 30 kids, and it's 5 weeks, and then another five, then another five, then another five. So I'm going to suggest it's probably around 150, 200 kids a school year. We'll only run it during the when the schools are in session. But I will get those numbers and get them back to you.
Could you get those and get them back to me? And since you have a base here in Marion County, let me know why you don't have that program there.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, the primary reason it's not in Marion County is that this is an Air Guard program and this is an Army aviation facility. Typically, states have taken the program, some have augmented with state money and expanded it, but typically it's on an Air National Guard facility. It doesn't mean we couldn't do it here. It just means that they're not going to pay for it. The feds typically are not going to pay for that. We were fortunate enough, we're the first state to actually take the allocated monies that we had by some leverage and some help primarily from the Klamath Falls School District, we were able to pull some of the federal money to start the second program at Klamath Falls. But they actually contribute to that. The school district does a small amount. So, but I will get you that answer.
Would you give me that? And could you give us some follow-up information from your educators as to what have been the results of the participation from their academic standpoint with the
students? Yes, ma'am. I know that's all captured in their data, so I can get that for you. Mm-hmm. Next program we have is our Yellow Ribbon program or reintegration program. As you may recall from previous testimony before this panel, we were one of the first states in the union to start that up. We actually started it up with primarily state dollars when we realized back in about 95, 96 that we were putting a lot of soldiers into the war zone, but the federal military looks at everything as in their through their glasses, and we don't have an active duty Army base, so we had challenges here that other states didn't without one. So we started our own program, a reintegration program. Since then, this has become a well-known subject matter for Congress. Congress recognized that this was a problem, particularly for states that didn't have those active duty bases. So they expanded the program. Today, I think we have 1.25 or maybe 1.5 state-funded positions in this. That's down from about 6. So we've cut that back. As the federal money came in, we pulled the state money back out. This has been very successful. We've also run a resiliency program through our Yellow Ribbon, and it deals with families, soldiers, and soldiers that have deployed, and also the resiliency pieces for soldiers who have not deployed. We had a very high suicide rate 5 years ago. I can report today that in the last 3 years, we've not had a suicide from any combat, no combat veterans. So I think we're moving in the right direction. It was a big concern of ours, and with this program and also the resiliency program to teach people how to deal with these issues. I think it's been a very, very big success for us. At least we're knocking on wood at this point. Our counter-drug program, the next program, is designed to assist law enforcement and the partnerships that we have there with skilled military personnel with capabilities that supports their overall mission. We are not cops. We don't do police work, but we back up police, and we add some of the things that we have available in our inventory and the skill sets that our people possess, and they assist in law enforcement analysis, you know, computers, you name it, whatever we can. And this program, again, is 100% federally supported. And those, as you can see in the write-up, you know, we have a constant presence in the HIDA, which is the Oregon High Intensity Drug Traffic Area, which is, I know that Representative Barker's probably intimately familiar with that. And this has been a good partnership because I think it's helped, helped our people understand the problem, which is good, but more importantly, to help the local law enforcement as they do their work. We also have a light armored vehicle, which is pictured up on the slide. We have two of those that are provided, again, 100% by the federal government. There's no local cost to that, and any law enforcement agency in the state that needs that for any type of activity, we will show up and we will do the operation of the vehicle. They do the police work. So it's been very successful in many, many areas. Also, we have what we call counter-drug program, where we actually have a team that goes into schools similar to the, what was the drug program?
DARE.
Similar to the DARE program, where we our trained personnel go in and work with primarily grade schoolers, middle schoolers. And, again, it's another attempt to try to stop the inflow as opposed to dealing with the problem. Also, we have two helicopters that are dedicated, again, 100% funded by the federal government to law enforcement. We work through the state police for this program to get our directions. We fly those helicopters with trained law enforcement people in them for observation, primarily for marijuana eradication. But there's also other capabilities that particular aircraft has. We are in the process of going away from the older Bell helicopters that are depicted here in that photo to a brand new helicopter, a scout helicopter that we'll be receiving this year. We'll receive two of those. Eventually, we'll have four. And that's, again, 100% paid for. We work with law enforcement. We're the driver. And we use our skills that we have to assist them in their mission. I will report in that program, we've seen a steady decline of federal assets to it. I don't know what the future holds. As we're looking at the federal budget right now, the defense budget, it's probably it's not going to be as robust as it was 5-6 years ago, but it's still going to remain here. They wouldn't be sending these new helicopters to us, so we're pleased to see that. And I know our law enforcement partners are very pleased to see it. Our Oregon State Defense Force is an augmentation to our active guard and reserve. This group, we've reorganized it over the last 5 years. The goal here is to provide, as we've noticed, our mission has changed on the federal side, where we had multiple deployments. We also move our leadership around more frequently than we did, say, 15 years ago. And we were losing contact with our local partners in both the county and city level with respect to the liaison work that we do. That being, and we just recently went through this, where we had several counties that declared emergencies. What we've done with the all-volunteer State Defense Force is we've placed them in a situation where they are the consistent person that the locals get to know. So they liaison back to the active guardsmen that we have, the 8,500 guardsmen we have. Mm-hmm. It's worked out very well. They've become, we've got them, we've been training them. They're all ICS qualified, incident command system qualified, which is a federal program. So they know how to work with local law enforcement. They have then, and are not law enforcement, but emergency operators. Those emergency operators have a consistent face and they can deal with on a regular basis. So there aren't any surprises when they do show up in their EOC in an emergency. So we've found that to be still a work in progress, like all of this is, obviously, but this has been a very good change in how we did our business model to make this work out better. The operations division, primarily this is our folks that take care of all of our facilities. Construction, do our construction, procurement, contracting, environmental, and planning support for real property and our infrastructure. We have 48 different armories. We have two major camps, but yet we also have five separate training areas. So we have a fairly large footprint in the state of Oregon as far as square footage goes. It's increased over the years, and yet our big challenge is trying to figure out how to leverage more out of the federal government so we can get them to pick up a bigger share of the bill. Used to be we had to pay 100% of all of the armory costs and everything that dealt with armories. Camps, on the other hand, where we had Camp Rylea, Camp Withicum, the bigger training areas, we could get 100%, or not quite, but almost 100%, 95% of the cost paid for by the federal government. That's since changed. We lobbied for that several years ago, and now we get our operations and maintenance picked up 50% by the federal government at our armories, which relieved the state of a considerable expense. That was other states are experiencing the same thing Oregon is with respect to lack of resources, and so it wasn't hard to get a cavalcade of supporters with our other National Guard partners. We also have numerous, and you'll hear in my next testimony, we have numerous responsibilities and reports that we have to provide to the federal government. Most of this is driven by Congress. The good news is that when a program comes up where they want more data, they most generally, probably 99.5 or 8% of the time, they provide the resources for us to hire the people to generate that report and that information. So again, we get to use it on the state side of our house, though, because it's data that we can use to better run our program. So it's a combination of state and federal employees in this group. And that, okay. Operations division, there's a lot of information on there. There's a picture right there of our latest armory that was just built. It's actually a Armed Forces Reserve Center. It was just completed. It was a $75 million project that came through the – it's a Camp Withicum. Invite you up there anytime you want to go. It's a tremendous facility. We closed two armories, one in Lake Oswego, one in Tigard, combined it here. Also closed an armory on the Camp Withicum base, so we put three different – elements into this, plus we added the U.S. Army Reserve, and that made it joint, and therefore we've qualified for the BRAC dollars to build that. So they in turn closed two. So there was five different facilities that were shut down to move into one. We got this weekend we had everybody drilling at the same time, which one would think that was the case, but we have 1,000 parking spaces there, and yet we ran out of parks. So that's the first time we've had that happen since we opened the building this last summer. But we've figured out a way to make that happen. Maybe not everybody needs to drive to the armory on Saturday morning. So that was, again, I'd certainly invite you up there. I think it's a real testament to being able to do take the federal money and get some really good out of it. And provide a tremendous number of jobs in the Portland metro area at a time when it was really needed. So we were pretty pleased with that. So the next slide shows you our services division. Continues on with that, with the services division. And again, our effort is to provide the training areas and the facilities to our men and women who serve in this organization to provide them the best possible conditions for them to get their training, complete their training, and be ready to either do the federal or the state mission. So that completes my presentation. There's a lot of information in there. I'd invite you to peruse it at your leisure. And if you have any questions about any of that, we'd be more than willing to sit down with you and get into more detail. But that's kind of the overview.
Question, Senator Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. General Caldwell, is this your do you do a strategic report for your plan about every 4 years to the legislature, or is this your first one? Or,
Madam Chairman, Senator Berger, statutorily we're required to report to the governor every year, which we do typically at the every year, every 2 years. Every 2 years. every 2 years that we give a report to the governor that details this same type of information. We're not required, we've not been required to do this for the legislature. We typically use that opportunity in our budget presentation to take this same type of information as it breaks down through the budget, and you would see many of the same statements, many of the same comments in the budget that you get. So it's not significantly different. It's just presented in a different fashion.
Follow up?
Senator.
I have the feeling somehow, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, I think you have some very successful programs, the Yellow Ribbon, the Young People's Program that you have, and yet I have the feeling that that's not communicated as well within the legislature. Am I wrong about that?
Madam Chairman, Senator Berger, I think it's in pockets. Yes, I would agree that people like sit on the committees like this get an understanding of what we do, how we do it. You're a small group out of 90, and some of them don't. We certainly, one of the things that you're dealing with in this session, I know, is the level of public affairs representatives, for instance, that state government ought to have. I think state government in total has a very good mission to tell, but I think we don't do the best job of telling it. Some of that's personnel related. Some of it is that it's an old adage, you know, I'm so busy chopping wood, I don't have time to sharpen my axe. Mm-hmm. And I think in some sense that's exactly where we are. We're awfully busy. As an example, if you look at just how we fund our maintenance and our upkeep in our budget, if you go back and look at 1991, we had approximately somewhere just a little bit south of a million less square feet than we have today under roof. Yet our budget's about 250,000, maybe 300,000, not in inflated dollars or anything like that, 300,000 more today than we had in 1991. So we've learned to leverage things and do things, but you do lose some of the nice things to have. When I first came to work at the military department 25 years ago, I was a public affairs officer. I was a state employee, and I had 4 state employees in the office, 1 federal. Today, I've got 1.5 state employees and 5 federal, or 4 federal. So, you know, this shift has been kind of a constant theme throughout, and we clearly don't do the best job of education for 90 folks that we would like to do. There's no question in my mind.
Well, I would just follow up, Madam Chair. I would just, in closing, my last comment would be that I would encourage you to do that for several reasons, and part of it is selfish. I think that we need to improve our respect for our military in the public, and so the best way to do that is when you have 90 legislators that think it's a pretty good thing, because they see a lot of people and talk to a lot of people. And so I think that your communication with legislators really increases your public image as well. And I do think that you do some very good things, and I fear that some of that is not quite communicated as well as it could be. So with technology, I know you're very limited in staff, but we also have improved in what we have accessible to us to communicate. And so that would be all I would say, is that selfishly, we need to think highly of your department and in the state. And so you need to let us know the things that you're doing and not have to have it in a budget note.
Yes. Well, Madam Chairman, Senator Verger, I appreciate that perfect advice. I don't disagree with you a bit. I think that's probably one of our weakest links. I will tell you that what we've learned, a lot of it through reintegration, quite frankly, is the reintegration program. Like I said, we're successful. We're one of the best in the country, but we're still not as good as we want to be. And to give you an example, we have most of the young men and women that are returning from combat zones, Iraq, Afghanistan, we're using tried and true methods of communicating information. We simply weren't getting the impact that we knew we needed to get. So we put together, believe it or not, a focus group of young soldiers and said, okay, you guys go through all this standard military briefings that we do when you get home. You get back to Fort Lewis or wherever you come through, you get it there. We bring you here, we give you 3 or 4 days more of it. Then we bring you back 30 days later, 60 days later, and 90 days later, and reemphasize the things that you've already gotten. And about 80% of them said, I never heard that before. It's the first time they recognize it because they don't have any desire but to get off the plane, get on the bus, get home, and to heck with all this other stuff. And so we've learned those lessons. So we sat them down and said, what would work for you? And, of course, every one of them has one of these things. They've got an iPhone. They've got a smartphone or a dumb phone, whatever they call them. And so now, just since about December, we've been working with using some of the federal dollars to bring in folks to do an app, believe it or not. So a kid can sit there, get his cell phone up, put it up there, hit the app, and they're going to get whatever information they may want out of different apps. Secondly, we've taken another approach to say, instead of waiting for you to ask, we're going to start collecting emails and we're going to start force feeding this information to you so it shows up on your message or your app or whatever you may want to have it. So they don't have to read it, but occasionally somebody may just click it and say, I wonder what's in this today. And then we're moving in that direction with our own folks. Once that's refined, we're going to offer that all to you too. So you can get on the list. We can force feed it to you. If you want to ignore it, you can. You can delete it, or you can say, I wonder what the guard's doing and what's going on with the guard right now. And so that's some of the things that were strategies that we've adopted in the last 6 months to try to get our information, our story, not only to you, you're important, but our soldiers are the most important thing, and we know we're not getting that information to them. So we're looking at every strategy we can look at and using technology to the best of our ability. So we're thinking the same thing.
Thanks.
Anybody else? Thank you, General. Mr. Borden?
The Legislative Fiscal Office notes a couple of things. One is that the material you received through the SharePoint site is, I think, a first draft. And perhaps what you have, the color copy in front of you that the department provided, is, I believe, maybe the final draft. But when we compare this report to other states' military department strategic plans, military department's report is absent many essential elements that comprise a comprehensive strategic plan. And so LFO would just recommend that to acknowledge receipt of the report, but instruct the department to come back to the Joint Interim Ways Committee on Ways and Means or the Emergency Board during September 2012 with a more comprehensive strategic plan that includes both their state and federally funded budget resources.
Madam Co-Chair?
I will make the motion to accept the receipt of the report. Just like a little more clarity from LFO after having the conversation or the comments from the good Senator Verger as to specifically when you say more information and detail on the comprehensive plan, specifically what is the staff's looking for in their request.
Madam Chair and Co-Chair Winters, you know, the staff is looking for something comparable to the state of Washington. For example, the state of Texas also has a good strategic plan, but a plan that includes such things as budget, organizational charts, some internal and external assessments about futuring. For example, General Caldwell mentioned, you know, the federal budget will be shrinking. Mm-hmm. So what will the department look like in the future? How is it going to manage the declining budget, both on the federal side and then those federal funds within the state budget? Some more of the things about the linkage between performance measures and outcomes. So kind of a standard comprehensive plan for the look forward to of what they're anticipating, how they're going to measure themselves, who's responsible, and what they're going to do. And again, this would be not just the state budget portion, but the department's entire budget, because there's a significant, you know, what's called off-state budget federal funds that flow to it.
Madam Chair,
it
would be helpful, I think, for this body as well as for the military department, if that is actually spelled out, you know, so that so that we've got some context in which the comprehensive, that what you're seeking from the comprehensive plan. You know, I served on, I need to talk about just a little bit, I served on the U.S. Air Force Academy Board of Visitors in that body. And I, you know, have some understanding when we start talking about strategic plan as it deals with a military a body, which is often somewhat different than when we're talking about budgets and nuances and stuff that we deal, you know, here. I appreciate the fact that we want to know what's happening in the future as federal funds are diminished and what have you, but I feel better, more comfortable if we knew what context and what we're looking for, so that we're not coming back all the time with constantly a budget note. And so it would just help me, you know, as a member to know what we're asking for. And so I need to put that on the record. And if you work with the military in order to get what it is that you need and want, I'd feel better.
And Co-Chair and
Mr. Borden.
Co-Chair and Co-Chair Winters, LFO is somewhat hesitant to be dictate what the strategic plan should look like. There are some great models out there, and we can provide the committee. But, you know, the department, the thing about a strategic plan is that it has to be owned by the entity creating it, and it has to make sense to them so that it's useful. And so we would want to be cautious there about imposing ourselves too strongly here to make a document that is not useful.
Then I would request something that's a part of your strategic plan. I get where you're going, because it's an issue that I, as a policymaker, have supported in this building for a long time. As you look at putting your strategic plan together, can you also address the question that some of us have raised that relates to Teen Challenge, for example? There's some of us who would like to see how you could and expand that particular effort. I mean, since we're talking strategies and strategic plan, for me, it would be helpful if you include that in your planning and your document.
Madam Chair.
And I know it takes state dollars.
And I was going to just get to that. When I came to work here 25 years ago, there was 102 state-funded 100% employees in the Reagan Military Department. Today, there are 17. So there's only so much that I can get out of the federal government. They do not pay these people to respond to legislative fiscal office. And I think, you know, I'm going to choose my words carefully here, because we are a very well-run organization. I can show you plans that go out 20 years on what we plan to do with our construction program, if you will, long-range construction plan. I got reams of paper. If you want it, I'll provide it. I don't have the people in my organization to sit down and do a writing exercise for the legislative fiscal office. And if you want to fund them, I'm all for it. But I don't have the people to do that. I'll leave it at that. And if you want to know money, I'm going to talk about money next.
Well. Senator.
Yes, I would like to respond to that. I think this is kind of a catch-22, where LFO is saying, we really don't want to tell you what the strategic plan looks like, and yet you have legislators that are wanting a strategic plan that's pretty detailed and laid out. So there's some gaps here that need to be fulfilled, and I think that this is not an impossible situation at all. I think that it can be worked out. You have very limited resources in order to create that. On the other hand, it's probably advisable for us to figure out some way that you can make that report. You are, I feel, a better run organization than is being communicated, and a good strategic plan would show that. And so I just don't see it as an impossible situation at all. I think that offline, I'd be happy to talk with you about that, and let's see what we can do to make things a little better. I think that the legislators have every right to want to see a detailed strategic plan. And they are very concerned, particularly about the budgetary issues, and so are we. That's what this committee is about. And so I'd be happy to talk with you, General Caldwell, and see what suggestions we might come up with.
I will make an appointment.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
And I might add, but as we request plans, and I did that deliberately, because as we request plans and documents and the more we ask, we also have to be ready to be able to provide those resources and what have you for those things that we ask for. And I would agree that sometimes we don't actually put up the resources when we're asking for all these plans and documents. And I also understand, and I think that perhaps there should be a preface in the documents as we present them, the recognition of when we talk funding, of that, how funding is generated, and the percentage of funds that are federal and not state, and how we have moved from state support to a greater federal support. And also, and how federal is dictating more and more of what happens, because they are the individual who is granting the largest share of the dollars. And maybe in providing the report, because I don't think all of our members understand that the way the dollars are come from and how they're utilized, we just kind of think that, oh, well, they're just dollars. So it would help me, and maybe that's something when you and the good senator get together, that as a preface leading into part of your overall how you exist and who pays for the majority of your existence.
I can give you that number.
And I will make the recommendation I think we beat that to death. Madam Co-Chair, if you want your recommendation now.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair.
Madam Co-Chair.
Oh, we lost a quorum here.
Work session, so.
Oh, I thought we were in work session.
Oh, we were in
work
session.
We're
in work
session. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we
okay,
are.
Thank you.
We're in work session.
Let me chase down a house member.
I'm sorry.
Madam Co-Chair, while we're just at rest here, I saw a lot of this in the demands of land use planning with small local government, and I think there's an analogy here.
Good point.
They had no staff to be able to present the material. They had no money to be able to pay them, and so there became this information gap and misunderstanding between it, and that was unfortunate. And we did arrange to take care of that, and so maybe we can do the same here.
Madam Chair, we did the same thing at the Air Force Academy. When we learned how it operated, how it was managed, we became the advocates for
That's
the
right.
improvements mm-hmm. of the infrastructure mm-hmm. and
I
some of the
this
financial needs.
Okay.
Madam Co-Chair, yes. I recommend acknowledging receipt of the report with instructions that the department report to the Joint Interim Committee on Ways and Means or the Emergency Board during the September 2012 with a comprehensive strategic plan that includes both state and federally budgeted resources.
Thank you. Senator Winters recommends acknowledging receipt of the report with instructions that the department report to the Joint Interim Committee on Ways and Means or the Emergency Board during September 2012 with a comprehensive strategic plan that includes both state and federally budgeted resources. Discussion on the motion. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I actually like the strategic plan. The military thinks, you know, in terms of a disconnect, in terms of how much direction we've given them, they think in terms of strategy, operations, and tactics. Strategy, we could say a strategy is to defend the United States of America. And, you know, General Caldwell is going to hear that and know what we're talking about. And so, I mean, to the degree that we're giving them direction, I think that's going to be helpful. But, I mean, we told them to go up with a strategy. The military would look at this and say, that's a strategy. So I like the plan. Thank you for your work.
Okay. Further discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, motion carries. We need a carrier? Senator Winters.
I'm being brave today.
Senator Winters will carry to the full committee. All right. Perhaps we can close that work session, open a work session on the military department report on comprehensive budget. General.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we submitted a letter on January 27th that deals with a budget note. The department's providing information in response to that note and what programs are funded apart from the department's state legislative approved budget. Included in the report is information on the Oregon National Guard's annual operating resources funded through the National Guard Bureau, annual funding program, and information regarding the 41 federal and state partnership programs, officially termed cooperative agreements, which are funded as part of the state legislatively approved budget. The budget note contained in 2011 HB 5037A reads and follow as follows. The department, quote, the department shall report to the appropriate House and Senate policy committees and joint committee on ways and means during the 2012 legislative session with a detailed report on all programs, plans, activities, audits, and audit findings, which are funded apart from the department's state legislative approved budget. The report is to include, but is not limited to, the state operating budget, state annual funding program, and all cooperative agreements and amendments submitted to the National Guard Bureau for the past three federal fiscal years, as well as proposed plans for the following federal fiscal years. In the report, you will find information, and I'm not going to read this whole report to you. It's several pages long, about 10 or so. In summary, in the past 3 years, give you one of the questions was audits. In the past 3 years, we've had 403 audits or inspections by the United States Air Force, United States Army, National Guard Bureau, State of Oregon Secretary of State, Department of Education, Federal Emergency Management Administration, and I probably missed a couple in that. 64 of those 403 were fiscal reports or fiscal audits, 55 were performance audits, and 284 were either inspections and or performance audits that we have in our department. The other, and I will, again, not bore you with all of the information, but if you go back to Enclosure 1, it gives a detailed, and if you want, I'll go through each one of them. It's up to you.
I don't need it, thank you, but if the members of the committee would like that.
Okay.
Thanks for the offer.
Yeah, you're welcome. Enclosure 1 gives you the detail of the program. Enclosure 2 shows you the federal dollars that are coming in and how we use those federal dollars. And there's also a portion of that minor spreadsheet that talks about cooperative agreements. The cooperative agreements are typically out of the in this case, out of the roughly $300 million in the fiscal year, federal fiscal year, in 2009, $70 million of that went through the state. The other did not. It was paid directly by the feds in one form or another. And if you move through that, those documents, you'll also see that the, where is it? And then we jump to 11 over the 2009-11. Again, there's $341 million in total expenditures, $75 million. As you can see, the difference, slight growth that goes through the MCAs, but a large growth, and that's really depicted because of the federal mission and the deployments and what we had to do to get our folks ready to get them to that deployment. So that's kind of been the trend. As far as trends go, and if you're watching anything in the news here lately in the open sources, there's a tremendous budget fight brewing right now at the Congress in all quarters. The military is clearly part of that. The future, as far as we can see it right now, which is very murky, is that the Army has taken the stance that the National Guard and the Reserve are a decent bargain for the buck. So there are very few cuts proposed right now within the Army Guard. We will go down in force structure 5 to 10,000. The active Army will go down 120,000 soldiers. The Air National Guard is a different story. The Air National Guard is being targeted by the Air Force to reduce the footprint that they have, the jets that they fly. Their proposal right now is to shut down somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 15 flying units throughout the country, none of which are going to happen to Oregon. We're blessed in Oregon for two reasons. One, because we sit in the strategic corner of the Northwest and have the mission to do air sovereignty. Right. And secondly, we have Klamath Falls Air Base, where we train, as I mentioned earlier, our pilots. And we have military operating areas that are second to none. We can fly over the ocean. We can fly over land. And they're huge areas down in southeast South Central Oregon, Christmas Valley. We've had that discussion. And that's where we train the pilots. So by virtue of geography, we're the only, probably at the end of this, we'll be the only state that has two flying units. Everybody else will lose a flying unit, if not completely curtail it. There's going to be a tremendous fight in Congress. I can tell you that right now, everything we're seeing, everything we're hearing. There's going to be a tremendous fight in Congress from other states about cutting the Air Guard to the degree that the Air Force wants to. And the argument goes quite simply that the Guard and the Reserve are a cheaper, more cost-effective way to keep our national assets up, and they've proven themselves in spades in combat and other missions. So that's how we see it at this point. I can tell you right now, I have no clue how that's going to come out. I don't think anybody does. But it's certainly going to be an impact in the next two-year cycle and budgets. And that could impact us dramatically, or it could impact us a slight amount. We don't know. We simply don't know. Because that's got to be fought out at the...
Madam Chair, General Caldwell and I remember very well a very scary time when it looked like they were going to close, or we were going to close.
Correct.
The training. And we all went to fight and battle over the fact that we were unique and we needed to keep that. And what a blessing it is that we were able to do that.
I would just, again, comment, Madam Chair, Senator Berger, I'd just comment that our argument was quite simple. You know, are you going to punish us because of geography, where we happen to be, when you've got the best flying? And there's, out of 365 days a year, about 310 of them you can fly at Klamath Falls.
Right.
You know, there's just not that many days in Klamath Falls where you can't put a jet up and do the training. And that's an advantage. The other advantage is that, and when Senator Mark Hatfield was chairman of Appropriations, he was very committed to improving the resource, the infrastructure at Klamath Falls. Mm-hmm. And I remember him telling me personally, we're going to brack-proof that base. Mm-hmm. And we've been very fortunate because of his ability to get those dollars to Oregon, that we were able to build the infrastructure, build the systems down there that have kept it very much alive in the Air Force's mindset.
Excellent. I'm mindful of the, as much as I would like to continue bragging about your effectiveness, I'm mindful of the clock, and we have another item on the agenda.
Yes, ma'am.
Any other questions? Senator Verger?
No.
Okay.
No.
Anybody? Madam Co-Chair? Or Mr. Borden, did you want to say something, or are we ready to go directly to Senator Winters?
I think Madam Co-Chair, I need to say just briefly for the record that while OM and military departments report provides some high-level information, it fails to provide the detail requested in the budget note.
Madam Chair, I recommend
Winters.
We acknowledge receipt of the report.
Okay. Senator Winters recommends acknowledging receipt of the report. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none?
Madam Chair, I hope all of us have been to deployments and deactivations. I've had the opportunity to do so. I'm very, very proud of the men and women who have served our country not only abroad, but also when we face challenges here in our state, whether those challenges are floods, whether those challenges are fires, whether those challenges are working with students, you know, the guards and are there. I just need to personally put that on the record. So that's enough of my kudos for today.
Good point. Good point, Senator. Thanks. Anybody want to carry this to full?
I'll be happy to carry. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Senator. Senator Verger will carry. Close that work session. One last one. Colleagues, hang in there with me. Open a work session on the Judicial Department. Report on the Oregon E-Corp General Fund expenditures. Thank you for your patience, gentlemen. Maybe that's presumptive of me, but thank you for still being here.
Madam Co-Chair, Bryant Baer, or members of the committee, my name is Bryant Baer. I'm the Chief Information Officer for OJD. Next to me is David Moon, the Chief Financial Officer for OJD. The budget note, as requested by the Legislature was for the Judicial Department to report on the expenditure of all general fund dollars budgeted or expended on the Oregon E-Corps program, including the additional $2 million general fund expenditure for operations and maintenance. Again, I won't, as previous presenters have mentioned, I wasn't going to read this to the committee. Just as the highlight is it details out what was spent on the appellate court management system, what's being spent on debt services, strategic planning, and it also details out expenses that are not certificate of participation or geo bond funding qualified. Past that, I'm available to answer any questions, or David Moon here as well.
Very succinct. Comment? Question? Senator Winters.
I just have one question, and that's on operation and maintenance, that when the project is completed, is the plan that the maintenance is done by individuals from within the state and that we're not contracting those out?
Senator Winters, that's a part A and a part B answer from the OJD end. Part A is we do have technical staff on site, our OJD employees that are working and maintaining our infrastructure, our servers, and also doing some base programming for configuration. The second part of it is when you buy software, you normally buy maintenance packages with that software. That involves paying the contractor to provide relevant updates, security patches, and anything else that may be required for OJD. So it's a part A and a part B.
I understand that, and I asked that question because I'm very delighted that the Oregon Health Authority and their new IT person, the plan, even for maintenance and what have you, is done in-house. And the reason for that is that we spend so many dollars that we are taking and using for our services out of the state. They become the consultant for putting the software together. They become the maintenance for maintaining the software. So there's so much money that's flowing out. I would like to figure out some way that a lot more jobs are created in. So that's my reason for the question. And if there's any way that you can talk to the OHA IT person and get some of the tips from her, I would thoroughly appreciate it.
Thank you, Co-Chair. We are making a sizable investment in Oregon and OJD folks, yes. Thank you. And I'll talk to the CIO.
I'm very serious about this issue. Mm-hmm. With the high unemployment rate that we have in this state, with workforce development, working on some of these IT issues to try to prepare our workforce, and if what we're doing as a state that, it's all outgoing. It's kind of the complaint that we raise about outsourcing to other countries. So I just ask you to take a look, maybe have some consultation with the new IT person for the Oregon Health Authority and figure out how they've done theirs, because I know that is the plan for that agency.
Happy to.
Thank you for your advice. Good point. Anybody else? Mr. Borden.
LFO would make it. Just two quick notes. One is that the department only charges positions with for that work on the program of greater than 0.5 FTE, so their general fund expenditures are understated. But LFO notes that the recent and significant progress made by the program on developing a comprehensive and consolidated budget is impressive, and that this new budget focus by the department will be of benefit both for internal stakeholders, external stakeholders, and the legislature. So with that, LFO recommends acknowledging receipt of the report.
Thank you, Mr. Borden. Madam Co-Chair?
Madam Co-Chair, I recommend we acknowledge receipt of the report.
Senator Winters recommends that the committee acknowledge that the legislature acknowledges receipt of the report from OJD. Discussion on the motion. Objections? Before I close, just a compliment as well. It's hard to get an impressive comment out of LFO. And having been involved at the very beginning when the E-Court project was first approved through the budget, I would echo the comment that the evolution to this date has indeed been impressive. I was hopeful of the promise that the e-court system would provide for the courts, and we're beginning to see those results. And it's really nice to hear from trial court judges and judges at the counties the difference that it's going to make for folks, and the accessibility of documents to the public will be very, very helpful. So thanks for hanging in there. Motion carries. I'll carry it. Thanks. Any more business? No. We're adjourned. Oh, we're adjourned.